U.S. President Trump toured fire-ravaged areas of California. VOA's Michael Sullivan reports the president toured the town of Paradise, California, which was incinerated by the so-called campfire north of San Francisco.
Trump visited the fire scene with California Governor Jerry Brown, newly elected Governor Gavin Newsom, and other officials. He had earlier accused California of bad management of the state's forests, creating a fire hazard, but he says everyone is moving now in the same direction.
We do have to do management, maintenance, and we'll be working also with environmental groups. They've really... I think everybody's seen the light, and I don't think we'll have this again to this extent. We're going to have to work quickly.
The deadly fire in Northern California was more than 50% contained on Saturday. The fire near Los Angeles is more than 80% contained. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
The Trump administration is taking issue with reports that a U.S. official, saying American intelligence agency concluded Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. AP's Ben Thomas has that story.
The State Department says reports that the government has made a final conclusion about the role Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman may have played in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi are inaccurate. Those reports cited a U.S. official who was not authorized to discuss the matter publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert says there remain numerous unanswered questions, and the department will continue to seek all relevant facts. The Saudi government has denied the claim that the Crown Prince ordered Khashoggi's killing. Ben Thomas, Washington.
And officials in northwestern India say 3 people were killed and 10 were wounded in an attack on a religious organization on Sunday. This is VOA News. The death toll from a cyclone that hit the coast of southern India has risen to at least 33. The storm has left a trail of massive damage to homes and roads and has driven tens of thousands of people into relief camps. Relief workers found 13 bodies Friday, an additional 20 on Saturday. Most deaths were caused by flooding, house collapses, and electrocution. The cyclone uprooted 30,000 electricity poles and more than 100,000 trees. State authorities rushed drinking water, food, and paramedics to nearly 82,000 people. At least 40 people were killed in Syria by strikes by the U.S.-led coalition. That's according to Syrian media and an opposition human rights monitoring group based in Britain. The coalition has not confirmed the reports. Meanwhile, the Syrian observatory says Syrian forces took back control of the Islamic State's last holdout in southern Syria as IS militants moved into the eastern desert. In U.S. politics, it's the deadline for the end of the Florida election recount, with Republican Governor Rick Scott continuing to hold a lead over incumbent Democrat Bill Nelson. This is for a seat on the U.S. Senate. The Florida governor's race was essentially decided after a machine recount resulting in a lead for the Republican candidate. In the neighboring state of Georgia, Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidate in the governor's race, ended her challenge in the closely fought election with Republican Brian Kemp.
Stacey Abrams ran one heck of a campaign, and I know she could be proud of that effort as well. Look, it's a tough business, politics. But the fact of the matter is the election is now over, and I've got to focus on governing this state, and that's exactly what I'm going to do.
And the close race drew national attention in part because of Abrams' effort to become the first African-American female governor. President Trump has again defended sending U.S. troops to the southern border with Mexico, saying that the migrants from the Central American caravan will not be allowed to come into the United States.
We have millions of people online to get into our country legally. And those people have preference. They have to have preference. They've been waiting for a long time. They've done it legally.
Of the thousands of migrants en route to the U.S., several hundred have arrived in the Mexican border city of Tijuana after a month of traveling away from poverty and violence at home in hopes of entering the United States. Injustice is the perverse of root of poverty. That's what Pope Francis said Sunday at a mass marking the Roman Catholic Church's Day of the Poor. He invited thousands of poor to St. Peter's Basilica for the Mass, and he is having lunch with them as well. He also made a reference to migrants when he called on people to pay attention to all those forced to flee their homes and native land for an uncertain future. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington.
Challenging the provisions of the Media Services Act, which violates the treaty for the establishment of East African Community.
Tanzanian civil society groups sue the government for restricting media freedom.
Someone says that is being peddled by their opponents. That's a lie. No, the evidence is on the ground. They have failed inside. It's evident. They have failed inside. Well, we have a party is well structured and has got a strong leadership.
Malawian main opposition party plans to form an alliance with Vice President Saulos Chilima's group ahead of next year's elections.
It helps global institutions and global citizens to look at the continent on its diversity, even diversity in performance.
And Grasa Michelle says the Mo Ibrahim Index plays a critical role in boosting Africa's democracy. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Tanzanian civil society groups and the Media Council have filed a petition in court to challenge what they say is the government restrictions on workers in the media. They contend that the government is undermining the country's constitution, which guarantees freedom of speech and press freedom. For more on their legal challenge, I reach Humphrey Ntui, a senior program officer at the Media Council of Tanzania.
In Tanzania, as of now, we have several laws that have been enacted and which impedes and have chilling effect on the journalism work. And these cases include, among others, the Media Services Act, there is Statistics Act, and there is also Electronic and Postal Communications Regulations, which control the online content. And in all these laws, we have approached the court to get their pronouncements on how they impede the media freedom in the country.
But Humphrey, the government is of the view that these laws that you've enumerated or act were implemented to protect the population against what some say is the fake news being peddled by journalists or media houses in the country.
By the way, because those cases are still in court and they are still pending, that might also limit my discussion and all this. So I may not go deeply into the matters because they are still pending in court.
What were some of the concerns the media practitioners in Tanzania expressed to you following the enactment of some of these laws and acts?
Okay, let me give an example. For example, we have the Media Services Act. This law made some of the matters, for example, we had the defamation. Earlier, we had the Newspapers Act that was there to facilitate defamation acts. But this law came and made the defamation as a criminal. It came with a criminal defamation. And it has serious measures against any publication and all that. It has number of years in jail or serious amount of money as fines. So we are concerned with this law because it is going to, in fact, it makes all media industry, people to be in worry. People can't write because they are fearing that they are going to be either jailed or they're going to be penalized to pay a certain amount of money.
Some are saying that why wouldn't the Media Council approach the Ministry of Information and, for that matter, the government to address some of these concerns instead of going to court about it? What do you say to that?
No. The Media Council work very closely with the government. We engage with them several times. And even, I would say, it was either June or August, we happened to meet the Minister for Justice, and he is a custodian of the Access to Information Act, which is one of the very good law, although there are some provisions which also have chilling effect. But it's one of the very good laws that it expressly states how people should get information, how the information holder should behave or should conduct. But we happened to meet him and we told him of what are the positives and negatives about that law. So we engage with them, but where we find we cannot go further, that's when we approach the court for pronouncement. Not because we want to fight them, no, because we want to make things work better.
So what would you say is the state of media freedom in Tanzania following the enactment of some of these laws that your members find quite challenging to work with?
Generally, I would say the media freedom, media, say state of media in Tanzania is a bit fragile, I would say. It's a bit fragile because of this multiplicity of laws. It makes people fear on going. For example, if you don't have investigative journalism, then many people won't be able to work or write something because, for example, the Statistics Act have a lot of requirements against those who are doing, for example, research and all that. There are a lot of cumbersome procedure which for a normal journalist it may not be easy to access and make his work good.
Does that mean some of your members find it very difficult to work under these laws, for example?
Definitely. Not some of the members, almost the entire media fraternity. They find it very hard to work under this legislation.
So what do you think are the prospects of coming out successful in this lawsuit, particularly when the Tanzania Constitution protects press freedom and free speech?
It's our take that all those laws violate some provision of the mother law, which is the Constitution. And we believe in the long run, after probably court pronouncements or our engagement with the government, we believe at one point these laws will come and be better for the journalists to work.
When do you expect the court to rule on this case?
We had a Media Services Act case in the East African Court of Justice, which was just concluded last Wednesday, and we are waiting for the judgment. We are not sure if it's going to come out before end of the year, but God willing, probably before end of the year, we shall have a judgment. We were challenging the provisions of the Media Services Act, which violates the Treaty for the Establishment of East African Community. We also have another matter in Mtwara, which challenges the electronic and postal online content regulation, which we are in the final stages as well. We have filed our submissions, and we hope to get the date for the ruling, for the judgment on the same too.
Humphrey Mtui is a senior program officer at the Media Council of Tanzania. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, is considering forming an alliance with the opposition United Transformation Movement, or UTM, ahead of next year's general election. The plan is generating mixed reaction after some analysts contend the alliance could bolster the chances of incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika of getting re-elected to a second term. The opposition UTM, which was officially registered as a political party, is led by the embattled Malawian Vice President Saulos Chilima. For the latest political development, I reach Albert Shara, a Malawian columnist based in the commercial capital Blantyre.
It was even shocking for most Malawians who follow politics to hear a political party, that is the main opposition party in Malawi, to hearing that it wants to partner with two other political parties. At the moment, what has been happening for the past 6 months, it has been, they came in vice president with his UTM. And if you look at the recent survey that has been produced by University of Malawi, it's called IPO, Institute of Public Opinion, it rated the MCP as the second powerful or second popular party in Malawi. The conclusion that we are making is that MCP now has lost its strength. They feel that on themselves, they can't unseat the ruling DPP. So they want to get more strength. And now what we see is that MCP is trying to protect the votes it can lose to UTM, the new party.
Is it unfair that an opposition party of the stature of the MCP could look critically and pragmatically at itself and decide that perhaps we'll be in a better place if we form an alliance with a new party to possibly wrestle power from incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika, who enjoys some power of incumbency ahead of the elections?
Yeah, but it's just a statement of saying that we are becoming weak and weaker. So what now the MCP is telling us as Malawians is that on our own, we can't eat Mutharika. That is what we are getting. Because the UTM has been standing, but they have been saying they want to unseat Mutharika on their own. But now this main opposition party is now coming and say we need an alliance. And the meetings have been taking place. So what now we are learning from MCD is that the new president is actually failing the party. He has failed to a point that he doesn't even have the confidence of himself in winning the election. And this has been building up.
Chakwara, the leader of the MCP and their presidential candidate for the next election, is of the view that Malawians have confidence in him to be able to wrestle power from the president, Arthur Peter Mutharika, saying that teaming up with another opposition party will strengthen MCP's hand in the effort to win first round in the election next year. You don't think that is justifiable?
To some extent, it's justifiable, but it has failed in Malawi several times. It's not the first time that the opposition have come into an alliance to unseat the government. And for the past 3-4 elections, they have all failed. Actually, the serious question that we should be asking now is maybe what kind of an alliance does Malawi need? Because if you look at the popularity of DPP, DPP came from opposition and unseat the ruling party. The PP then, it doesn't mean that you need an alliance. It means that it all takes up on you as a party. What are you doing on the ground and how strong are you building? But now the insights that have been building up in MCP are now they've been also struggling financially. They have not been on the ground enough. They haven't been beaten by UTM. All those factors have weakened the party too much that now they are relying on maybe going into an alliance. But I'm also thinking from my own point of view that even if they go into an alliance, it will be another alliance that can unseat the ruling government. They're just giving the DPP an edge over the opposition. And this is November. Soon we'll be going to December and February. The campaign period will be up. So Malawians are people who are difficult to change. The problem, we are always controlled by what the social media takes, which is only dominated by only 10% of the people, who are most of them in the urban. To convince a rural person to vote for you, it's not A, B, C, D. That is why over these years, it is only the rural people that win the vote.
Albert, MCP people are saying that these reports of infighting and leadership troubles are just a figment of people's imagination and fake news peddled by DPP supporters and opponents of the MCP, who are afraid that Chakwera is going to become the next president of Malawi. What is your take?
No, that is the fallacy. The evidence is on the ground. At the moment now, the fights are becoming serious because they're affecting the senior party members. The two constituencies in which they are supposed to have rerun for primaries. We have Juliana Lunguzi. She's popular in MCP. She's one of the people who has been creating an image for MCP. And we also have got another MCP in Kasungu, that is a strong one for MCP, Jessica Bwira. They also, they want to feel their own people, whom they prefer as a party, and not the people, the candidates that the people want. So if someone says that is being peddled by their opponents, that's a lie. Because the evidence is on the ground. They have failed inside. It's evident, of course, they have failed inside. Because when a party is well-structured and has got a strong leadership, those wrongs, they do not come out. If everything was fine, then they would have finished the primary, because they started earlier than most of these parties. But no, I don't accept that all this is being peddled by the opposition or their opponents. No.
Albert Shara is a Malawian columnist. He spoke with me from Blantyre. Meanwhile, the Malawian Electoral Commission has announced the official end to the voter registration process. This after declaring that the voter registration process was successful, with 6.8 million citizens registered to vote in the presidential, legislative and local representative elections. For more on the upcoming polls, I spoke with Justice Dr. Jane Ansah, chairperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission.
Well, such criticisms, we deal with them by engaging the stakeholders, explain the processes that they do not understand so that they should understand. One thing that has affected us negatively are these allegations that the US elections were hacked. And now when you introduce technology and internet, they think if the US elections were hacked, what about us? What do we have to combat would be hackers, to stop hacking? So being here, I have understood how the US process works and how secure it is. So the fact that the allegations that the U.S. elections were hacked, it has not stopped the U.S. government from running the midterm elections in a similar way, using the same internet. But of course, I believe because of this allegation, they have taken extra effort to ensure that the process is safe. There's a security, it cannot be hacked.
Some of political parties are calling for the postponement of the election. Some of them are saying they don't trust the system. Some of them said they don't think you will administer free, fair, transparent, and credible elections next year. What is your response to that?
My response is that those allegations, those claims are baseless. For the simple reason that Malawi is coming from a single-party democracy. We came up with a constitution. We have come up with electoral laws. And those electoral laws are the ones that provide the appointment of the chair, person of the electoral commission, commissioners, and who appoints. And it has been like that from time immemorial. Now, their reason is that we were appointed by the particular appointing authority, who is the president. In the past, presidents have done the same. I don't think they have any ground for making those claims. In fact, it also comes from ignorance. I've explained to them that according to the law, the chairperson must be a judge. And who bankrolls the process of appointment? It is the Judicial Service Commission that actually looks at the judges and then recommend particular names to the president. Of course, by the end of the day, is the president that is appointing, but the beginning is the Judicial Service Commission. So for them, they just look at the appointing authority without looking at the process.
What should Malawians expect in next year's elections?
They should expect transparent, free, fair, and credible elections.
So what will be your final words, Madam Chairperson?
My final words are that the Electoral Commission in Malawi only manages elections. It is the political parties and the people who field candidates. Therefore, Malawi Electoral Commission cannot work on its own. It works with the stakeholders. My prayer to Malawi electorate is that let us work together, let us cultivate confidence in the systems that our law has laid down, because everything that the Electoral Commission is doing according to the law. So they must be confident in their own law, the laws that they have made, and believe that everything will be okay. And in particular also, we have enhanced ways of making the whole process transparent. I will call upon them to participate in the processes so that they understand and actually witness the whole process.
Justice Dr. Jane Ansah is the chairperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission. She spoke with me from the U.S. state of Maryland. Grasa Machel, a humanitarian and a prominent member of the Africa Progress Panel, says the Mo Ibrahim Index Award is playing an important role to deepening the tenets of democracy in Africa. Machel, who advocates for equitable and sustainable development in Africa, says the Mo Ibrahim Index generates a healthy competition between African countries to work towards entrenching democracy and good governance for more. VOA's Paul Alexander reached Grasa Machel in Johannesburg, South Africa.
So do you think the Mo Ibrahim Award is having any meaningful impact in strengthening Africa's burgeoning democracy?
Absolutely. The fact that the Mo Ibrahim Index is categorizing in many aspects where each country stands, it gives a measure of what is the effort every country has to make to align with the high goals which they have defined, whether it's in their 5 years plan, and some of them they have adopted plans of more than 5 years. So knowing where you stand, and with all this detail of different items which comes, it helps in planning. Second, it also helps in terms of competing, because governments look and say, oh, if my neighbor is doing better, I should be able to do as well. No one likes to be seen as the one who is at the last level. As you know, there are countries which are in the least, developing in terms of a democratic governance issue. Then there is another element. It helps civil society organizations to advocate and to make pressure on governments to improve. Because it's not only to know, but it's to compare. And civil society have been very active as well, pushing for government to improve, whether it is in political systems, whether it's in economic systems, or even in social. The foundation doesn't only publish a report. It does engage different constituencies on the report. And it helps to private sector, for instance, to have their own conversations on how they can improve and how they can relate better to public institutions to make, in this case, to make the economy work. There are other sorts of engagement, for instance, with the media. And when the governance weekend happened, where the Mo Ibrahim convened, you have discussions on public institutions and business, on academics, on media, and other civil society. So it has been a sort of benchmark which helps the debate to have a very solid evidence-based information to say what to improve, where to improve, and not only at the national level, but even in sub-regions. As you know, we have the so-called regional economic communities, and again, continent-wide. It has been a very powerful tool to anchor the debate towards improvement of governance, but improvement of education systems, of economic programs, etc. Please take the approach of how the report is presented, the Mo Ibrahim Index. I think it helps global institutions and global citizens to look at the continent on its diversity, even diversity in performance, so that the narrative on African continent will be better structured, and not to throw a blanket of statements giving the impression that all African countries are at the same stage, all of them are underperforming in everything. Even countries which are not in the highest level, like the Mauritius, Namibia, etc., they are countries which are performing well in certain aspects. And it's good to recognize that, so that we don't continue to have a narrative of Africa's all gloom and doom. The index itself is an indication of some progress, and that progress has to be valued. And even in those countries, we are not performing it very well, but they are performing well in certain aspects. And it's very useful in the reading of the dynamics of the continent to value those aspects.
Grasa Machel is a humanitarian and a prominent member of the Africa Progress Panel, or APP. She spoke with viewers Paul Alexander from Johannesburg, South Africa. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the process of removing Sudan from the U.S. list of states of sponsoring terrorism will start soon, according to the Sudanese Foreign Minister. Eldal Diri Mohamed Ahmed said his recent meetings with U.S. officials were effective in convincing Washington that Khartoum has taken measures against terrorism. He tells viewers Fatiha Bel Fakir that Sudan looks forward to being removed from the list of sponsors of terrorism.
First, we should state that the listing of Sudan in the list of states sponsoring terrorism was politically motivated. There was no action of terrorism that was traced to Sudan whatsoever. Even the reference to the existence of Osama bin Laden at one particular time in Sudan, that has taken place way before he has taken to his terrorist acts and in activities that were very much known and acknowledged by everybody. So the listing was politically based. And now the delisting is also very much intertwined with politics. As you have said, the United States already acknowledged that Sudan is doing tremendous efforts with respect to combating terrorism in that part of the world. The United States had already issued some reports in this area. But nonetheless, we are right now just starting a lengthy process of delisting Sudan, and this process is right now starting at a political level, and it would continue for quite a time at the political level, and then after that it will start at the legal level and for a prescribed period of time. So it's a political process that led us to this list, and now a political process that is supposed to lead us out of it, of this list.
According to Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, there are concerns about human rights violation in Sudan, including suppression of peaceful demonstrations, attack on media, and ongoing violence and torture. What do you say to this concern?
Well, of course, Sudan is part of the region in which it lives, in which it's situated. We are suffering a lot of problems in that part of the world. We're facing a lot of difficulties. And, of course, those difficulties are very much connected to the performance of countries when it comes to issues of human rights. Nonetheless, particularly over the previous few years, Sudan's performance in the field of human rights had improved immensely. Out of the year 2017, that was recognized by the Human Rights Council. Now, in the year 2018, Sudan is being accepted as a country that would exit the special procedures before the end of this year if it accepts that a human rights office would be situated in the country. We are working closely right now with the UN Human Rights Commission to see to it that this office will be established in due course, and then Sudan exits the special procedures on human rights, a testimony to the improvement that is being made in Sudan with respect to human rights.
Sudan economy is clearly not in a good shape. Some blame it on sanctions. Others blame it on Sudan's government's economic policy and corruption. What do you say to those who accuse your government of corruption?
Of course, measures have been taken in the country to address all of issues that has been raised with respect to corruption. We have started a crack on corrupt entities, and this is a process that would be continuing. It's an ongoing process. Nonetheless, when it comes to the economic difficulties we are facing, those are very much related to the sanctions that we are now in because of the decision that was taken by the United States of America. Because of the sanctions, the average Sudanese cannot access medical services. They can't travel outside of the country or return to the country because also of the effect of sanctions on aviation. They can't even also find or very important services at reasonable prices because of the escalation of prices and because of the inflation in the country, and you name it. Definitely the country is suffering a great deal because of the economic sanctions that were imposed by the United States, and by far that cannot be compared to any accusations or claims of corruption that might be existing in the country.
Dadiri Mohamed Ahmed is the Sudanese foreign minister. He spoke with viewers Fatiha Belfakir from Washington, D.C. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports Info. Let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Morocco qualified for next year's Africa Cup of Nations without kicking a ball on Saturday, while Mali won 1-0 in Gabon to progress. The Atlas Lions qualify with a game spare after Comoros' shock 2-1 home win against Malawi. Morocco beat Cameroon 2-0 on Friday in Group B, while Mali made it through from Group C. The Eagles' narrow win means they are guaranteed to finish in the top two. Gabon, meanwhile, must win in Burundi to have any chance of making the finals, but a home win will take the East Africans their first Nations Cup. Mali has 11 points from Group C, while Burundi, who beat South Sudan 5-2 on Friday, have 9, 2 more than Gabon, while the South Sudanese have yet to win a point. Mali and Morocco join Egypt, Madagascar, Nigeria, Senegal, Tunisia and Uganda in next year's finals. The final round of Group B games take place in March, with the Indomitable Lions assured their place as Nations Cup hosts. The Cameroonians are participating in the qualifiers to ensure competitive match practice, and they sit second in the group with 8 points, 2 fewer than Morocco, while Comoros rise to 5 points, 1 more than Malawi. The win is the only third for Comoros in Nations Cup qualifying history, following on from victory over Mauritius in the 2019 preliminary phase, as well as the 1-0 win over Botswana in 2017 qualifying. Senegal, meanwhile, won 1-0 in Equatorial Guinea on Saturday, courtesy of an own goal to extend their lead in Group A. The Senegalese now have 13 points, 3 more than second-placed Madagascar, who host a Sudan side looking for their first points in Antananarivo on Sunday. Uganda qualified for the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations after beating Cape Verde 1-0 in Kampala on Saturday. Tanzania can take Group L's second spot if they win in Lesotho on Sunday. Should they succeed in Maseru, Tanzania would celebrate only their second Nations Cup qualification and first since 1980. Group L concludes in March when Tanzania hosts Uganda and Lesotho travel to Cape Verde. Elsewhere, Namibia were held to a goalless draw by Guinea-Bissau in Windhoek, meaning that Group K will be decided on the final day. The Gambia also lifted themselves back into the reckoning after winning 3-1 at home to Benin in Group D. The Baby Scorpions joined Togo on 5 points, 2 behind the joint leaders Algeria and Benin. On Friday, Mohamed Salah scored a last-minute winner as Egypt beat Tunisia 3-2. Both sides have already qualified. The tournament will be hosted in Cameroon from June 15th to July 13th, a change from the usual January-February schedule. And the Council for East and Central African Football Associations, SECAFA, confirmed that the 2018 Senior Challenge Cup, scheduled to start later this month, will not take place. Nicolas Bisogni, the SECAFA Secretary General, said they had struggled to find new hosts after Kenya pulled out of staging the event. But Musonye confirmed that Uganda will host the SECAFA Under-20 Championship, which runs from December 15th to December 23rd. Also, Namibia are blaming a financial squeeze on their decision to withdraw from the opening round of qualifiers for next year's Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations, which will determine which countries represent the continent at the 2022 Olympics in Tokyo. Finally, the tennis season's grand finale concludes in London on Sunday as the O2 Arena plays host to the ATP Finals. World number one Novak Djokovic beat South African Kevin Anderson to reach the final. The 14-time Grand Slam champion, who has not dropped a set all week, won 6-2, 6-2. The Serb will play Germany's Alexander Zverev in Sunday's season final. The 21-year-old Zverev beat Roger Federer 7-5, 7-6, 7-5. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And coming up, techno with Way, Yemi Alade with Johnny, Fuse ODG featuring Tiffany on Azonto, and Rima with Touch My Buddy.
Johnny, where is my Johnny? Johnny. for me. I'm looking for my honey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're telling me this, you're telling me that. I say this is not for me. Johnny do me corny.
Johnny
do me corny. He's doing me this, he's doing me that. But I know what's him on me. He go Canada, he go Tokyo. Yesterday he say he de Morocco. He dance the sicko, he sing a willow. Na lie, na lie, na Pinocchio. Ha, this one na go be. Original Gobe.
As you can see, we are leading them, everybody, to discover where Johnny is. There's no way we will not take
you home.
Is that Johnny?
To see you deep in crisis. Drive yourself, you don't need a license. Holler her, she can even ride it. Go ahead, move your feet just like this. Then he showed me the latest. We walk over them haters. Now what you do, man, ya zonto. Azonto, azonto. Now watch me do my zonto. Azonto, azonto. Now watch me do my zonto. Azonto, azonto. Now watch me do my zonto. Azonto. We walk over them haters. Now what you do, man, ya zonto. Zonto, zonto. Azonto, zonto, zonto. So I'ma take you right through this. As on to dance, it's the movement. So when you jump on the floor, better use it. First step is a step, step. You can move to the right, to the left, left. You can even freestyle when you step, step. Put your hands in the air and you rep, rep. So go, go, go. Twist your fingers, you can wave and say hello, low, low. Make a fist and you can hit them with that blow, blow, blow. No balance, that's how you do it. So, so, don't let me see you go. Nobody wanna see you rising. And when they do, they don't even like it. They just wanna see you deep in crisis. Drive yourself, you don't need a license. Holler her, she can even ride it. Go ahead, move your feet just like this. Then he showed me the latest. We walk over them haters. Now what you do, man, ya zonto. Azonto, azonto. Now watch me do my zonto. Azonto, azonto. Now watch me do my zonto. Azonto, azonto.
not to we'll blow. Move to the rhythm, here we go. I'll show you how to do this. So, so men sa, men kasa, up across on the south side. Move to the left and right and watch me free. I don't go. All my ladies try to pose and free. Trafoto. Drop it low and make the boys say damn. Kusombo. Freestyle it the way you want to say. Uchimo.
What you do when you zonto? Azonto. Azonto. Now watch me do my zonto. Show me.
Rema, Touch My Buddy. But before then, you heard Fuse ODG featuring Tiffany Azonto, Yemi Alade, Johnny, and Techno Ware. That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Africa, we have a problem in Ethiopia. Campaigners of good government throughout the African continent could not have dreamt of a better transforming leader than the current Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed. In two previous commentaries, we have examined the surprise meteoric rise of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. We have looked at his attempt to promote rapid reform, his response to the call of the people to observe human rights and political rights by releasing political prisoners, including a leader of the opposition. We have also looked at his attempt to reform the economy and political sectors of the countries. Similarly, we have looked at his rapprochement with Eritrea and Djibouti, developments which are already transforming political and diplomatic life in the Horn of Africa. We have also seen his plans and attempts to ease relationship with the Sudan and Egypt with respect to the waters of the Nile, particularly the building of the Grand Renaissance Dam in Ethiopia. Now we are seeing a critical stage. In response to those calling for gender equality in government. In October, he announced a cabinet with half of the members women. He already moved to see the appointment of the first woman president of Ethiopia in the person of an articulate Ethiopian diplomat. And last week, we see for the first time that he's taking on the military and the intelligence agencies. Reports have shown that top echelons of the military and the intelligence agency have been arrested. And we have also heard from Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed that those opposed to his reform moves and rapprochement have made attempted assassination against him. They have moved to stage coup d'etats against him. And therefore, in this critical stage, Africans must bear in mind that fighting corruption is always an uphill fight. Those accused of corruption or alleged corruption will always fight back. And they will fight back not by themselves alone, but with their families, with their friends, with their collaborators. And even when those fighting against corruption and malpractices come with squeaky, clean hands, they will fabricate allegations against them to deter them. They will use all means at their disposal to prevent the unraveling or the revealing of corruption. So this is the time for Africans to see that trying to deal with corruption and poor government in Africa needs all hands on deck. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed now has the full support of the Ethiopian people. But that will not be enough for a determined group that will want to continue corruption practices which have been the bane of the people of Africa. And therefore, the call is that the international community should do everything possible to support a leader like Abiy Ahmed. And what he's doing is to show to Africa and perhaps to the world that it is necessary and maybe required for clean government, because we know that corruption is not an African problem alone, it's a global problem. And if he succeeds, then Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed will be the kind of transforming leader that Africa should be proud of. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdun, and our engineer for today, Mr. Cornelius Tino. We say thanks for joining us, and remember, as the elders say, the one who asks questions doesn't lose his way. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News.